Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Doomer Optimism podcast. I am here with a couple time co-host, Roland Gunn, and a new guest for the first time, friend to the Doomer Optimism sphere on Twitter, Jonathan Rawls. Let's start by having you, Jonathan, just sort of introduce yourself, a little bit about your background and things you're up to now, and we can dig in a little further. Oh, and I would just say before you do that, the way I'm envisioning this interview is as a part of a series that ideally will inform my book, my forthcoming book, the research for my book with Chris Ellis on prepping. So I think of this as like a prepper episode. So I'm just gonna put that out there. I'm gonna be talking to all different types of people who think of themselves as preppers or doing different preparedness activities. And Jonathan falls into that category. So, welcome to both of you. And Jonathan, if you want to start by giving us a little biography, we'll start with that.
Yeah, thank you. Really glad to be here. A biography on me as it relates to prepping has to start with my family, with my father first of all, who's a preparedness expert in along those lines. He wrote a book called Patriots back in starting back in the 90s, which for some people played a significant role in kind of getting into the idea of preparedness out there, concepts like Teotihuacan, the end of the world as we know it, and part of that genre of total collapse and how you might go about responding to it. So I grew up, I would say, largely in that movement. We lived in a very rural area. I was homeschooled. We did a lot of gardening, raising livestock, and shooting, hiking, camping, all those things that kind of go with living that lifestyle. Going from there, went to college for engineering, went into that field. But along with that, I've also been working in real estate, primarily working with people that are looking for that kind of rural remote property. And so I've had a chance to continue working in that. Since then, also wrote a book in the preparedness space, co-authored with my father, and continue to work in those areas. And what I would say ultimately I'm interested in is seeing how that question of preparedness really overlaps with everything else. Because you not only have to prepare for what might happen, but live where you are right now.
Okay, interesting. So, Roland, I want to get you to jump in here because I know you followed this movement, Jonathan's father, a little bit. So let's dig into the history a little bit first, and then go into what you're up to lately. So, Roland, do you have some specific questions on that?
Yeah. So, Jonathan, your dad is kind of the OG prepper specialist guy from back in the day. Was that a weird way to grow up for you? Being part of this sort of notorious, not infamous, but notorious prepper clan?
Definitely at times. So I can say he does like to live a very private, low profile life. So in some sense it was not a thing that was, widely talked about. It was so in that sense we lived a pretty normal life, but we also, kind of grew up with a mentality that looked at the world probably quite differently than a lot of other people did, with a very keen awareness to the fragility of it, to the inherent threats that are, all around us. And of course, living a lifestyle where, we had a very well stocked pantry and garage and shop, and largely had, whatever we might need for whatever circumstances would come along, and really trying to prioritize that. I would say it was definitely a unique upbringing in that respect. I would say it was not one that was overly marked by paranoia per se, as far as, looking at, oh, thinking things are going to fall apart tomorrow, or, helicopters are coming type scenario, but one that really focused on trying to build self-sufficiency, which I think in some sense is maybe even a better term than prepping itself.
Yeah, okay, good. And then can you talk to us a little bit about like this movement that was kind of centered around your dad? Like, who are the type of people that were drawn to it? Who are the type of people reading his book? What like situated in like the history of prepping, if
Yeah, so he, yeah, so if you look at my dad's influences, he would point to people like Gary North and Mel Tappan and other early survivalist writers. He doesn't say he originated anything by any means. But these were, so Mel Tappan was kind of your old school, more nuclear war, collapse of civilization type prepper that came out of the Cold War era. My dad grew up in Livermore, California, right near Lawrence National Laboratories. So the bomb was high on everyone's radar. There was a large number of, you know, bomb shelters in his own, in the neighborhood he grew up in. So that was somewhat the environment he grew up in. And then that gets combined with some of the work that Gary North and other Christian Reconstructionists did on two sides there. Gary North was very much involved in the preparations for and consideration of the Y2K bug, things like that, where he really saw the potential risk there and was advocating people getting prepared for that. But that came from a deeper thread of this particular thread of Christian Reconstructionism, which is kind of trying to recover a understanding of what a rightly ordered society should look like, and looking at our society and realizing that it's not well ordered. And as they say, anything that cannot go on forever because it's not well ordered will at some point stop. And so in that sense, we should be expecting that and prepared for that, because that's just an inevitability.
Mm-hmm. And do you see yourself as part of this lineage, or like, where do you fit in the Christian Reconstructionism worldview?
Yeah, I would say, I think I'd say the Christian Reconstructionists, I've mentioned to you, Crawford Gribben wrote a great book, Survival and Resistance in Evangelical America, that actually profiles a lot of the work my dad did and some of those other influences. So I'd say Christian Reconstructionism is one influence, but there's kind of that broader picture. Myself, I would say I'm just a traditionalist, Protestant, Presbyterian, not necessarily a Reconstructionist, but I've been influenced by some of those views. When you look at the people that are coming towards the survivalist movement in the Christian world, you've got a pretty good variety, because you've got the Baptist millennialist view that's largely looking at, you know, being prepared for the tribulation itself, the biblical tribulation of 7 years. So some are anticipating that. Others are, you know, more anticipating just ongoing instability. And so that can have, in some cases, actually optimistic that we go through hard times and things can get better, the church and the kingdom can advance, whereas others, of course, see things going to hell, quite literally. So you get a really interesting intersection of theological outlooks when it comes to prepping, which can make for some interesting discussion sometimes.
Oh, yeah, totally. Roland, do you have anything? I have a couple of other follow-ups.
Yeah. So one of the things your dad is known for is, I think, I'm going to butcher the term here, but the Great American Readout, I think.
Readout, yes.
Idaho, Montana, the Dakotas, maybe Wyoming. Can you talk a little bit about that idea?
Yeah, absolutely. So that term came out of an article he wrote on the whatever we're calling that first decade of the 2000s. That was kind of looking at, I think, largely at the time, Democratic presidency, and the picture of the country as a whole kind of headed in a very problematic direction, and the hope largely that certain areas is a localist impulse, that certain areas would be more likely resilient to that, both in a practical standpoint from self-reliance, economy, lack of extremely high unsustainable population densities, and also on a political standpoint, these are largely conservative areas that aren't completely enmeshed in the social and governmental power structures. So he wrote that article right around 2010. And then in the years since, there's been a fairly steady stream of people that either directly or largely indirectly have been relocating largely to the inland Northwest. But then there's been similar concepts, of course, with Appalachia and more recently, more prominently, Texas and Florida, which I think is all a similar impulse.
Okay, so that's super interesting. So, I have more questions on that, but I wanted to ask one other background question, like philosophical, that will help us to understand where you're coming from. So you mentioned this, like, varying ideas about what to prepare for, and I feel like this is something that is the doomer optimism, people drawn to it have also varying opinions about, like, how bad are things meant to get? Is it going to be like all at once, extreme apocalyptic, or is it just like a slow decline? I tend to think that, like, from a secular point of view, there are just going to be periods of accelerated decline and then periods where that's cooling off. Like, I felt like the 2016 to 2022 period was pretty chaotic, like politically pretty chaotic,
Yes.
information wise, like then COVID, and just a very, like, pretty steep relative to recent memory decline. And then it seems to have, like, cooled off a bit and not felt so extreme. But, like, where do you stand on that spectrum? And, like, this concept you've mentioned before, the end of the world as we know it. There's, like, the end of the world, which is, some harsh end point that where, like, something stops and another thing begins. But then the end of the world as we know it just suggests a transformation, not necessarily like a one hard stop point and then something else comes after. So yeah, like, just where do you fit on that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so yeah, so I would say I don't fall into the end of the world camp in that respect. I think that whether we're talking extinction of humanity or the end times, I'm largely optimistic as far as my what's happening with the world as a whole. But I also see a lot of, possibility for a lot of very hard times to come. And I think, I mean, anyone that takes a realistic view would see that.
Yeah.
So I would say the biggest question is the scale of the collapse. So when you look at my dad's novel Patriots, you're looking at something that is a total rapid collapse. And he'll say that he's wrote that in that sense, largely, to provide drama and interest and to give the full range of what you might need to be prepared for. The reality is that not every collapse is everything all at once. And in reality, as you mentioned with COVID, there are a multitude of smaller collapses, that happen on a daily basis. And so ultimately, preparedness, or self-reliance, resiliency ends up being a question of being prepared and able to handle the catastrophes that come our way. Whether it's a personal one of, a major injury or illness or losing your job, some basic level of preparedness will actually, help you with that. Or we're facing a very long-term degradation of our society and civilization, or if we're facing a true, natural disaster or societal collapse.
Roland, did you have something you want to add there?
No, I agree with the philosophy. I think there's a lot of benefit to being prepared, even if there's not a T.O. to Waukee or whatever you call it. You can benefit. I mean, right now, there's a tropical storm Lee hitting Maine. I'm sure that a little bit of prepping has probably helped some of our friends up there.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think one thing that's important to realize there is one thing I occasionally harp on Twitter is the fact that you have to your plan for the end of the world also has to be your same plan for the world not ending. Again, there's real threats out there. I would still argue that the Y2K threat was a real threat, which largely was averted and didn't have any lasting effects, but there were, possibilities for grid down situation, things like that. But there's also people that sold their homes, put all their life savings into preparation for that. I'm speaking of, actual people that I know of. And that had very serious ramifications for them, really for their personal life, for their marriages and families, because they became, so set on this one event that was going to happen that was, I mean, again, I'm not going to try to armchair quarterback it at the time was a very serious threat, but they didn't have a plan for what happened if it didn't pan out the way they were expecting. And I think that's a really critical aspect of preparedness as a whole.
Yeah, that's sorry, you go ahead, Roland.
I think that's a constant question in the doomer sphere, and I think it's something you have to watch out for, is that you do have people that sort of spiral into these doomer spirals and maybe have a little too much paranoia, end up kind of divorcing themselves from normal mainstream life completely, and that doesn't really help you long term or short term. So
yeah, and I would just add, like, I think this question of how to navigate your sense of uncertainty or whatever it is that you feel doomery about is like basically the question of the podcast. And there's so many things to think about, and which is why it's been so easy to put out two episodes a week for like 2 years. But like, I mean, which collapse, which doom, if there is some doom, what's realistic to happen? And what might be far-fetched, but you should be thinking about in the back of your head? And then what do you do in response? And if what you're doing in response is like hinging on collapse happening, that's probably not very sustainable. It's got to be something you want to be doing anyways. So in that vein, this readout movement, I mean, I guess we could talk a little bit about, so you are in real estate, like where you're trying to help people get set up in properties, at least in the inland Pacific Northwest. So I'm looking at this map on Wikipedia, the readout movement. So it's like Eastern Oregon and Washington, Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. I spent some time in Pullman, Washington, which is Eastern Washington, where I got my PhD at Washington State. But like, tell me, I didn't really realize that like Moscow, Idaho was like this little hub. My sense of Moscow was just that it was like a liberal, college town, University of Idaho is there. And it was funny at the time, I always kind of laughed that going from Pullman, Washington to Moscow, which are like, you know, only a few miles apart on the border there, I was like going to Idaho for culture because there was like a lot more culture going on in Moscow than there was in Pullman. And so, yeah, just tell me like your sense of what's going on in that region. I think a lot more people talk about the Texas case and the Florida case, like the Florida, if I'm going to draw very vague descriptions here, Florida feels a little bit like a crypto hub, like people fleeing Silicon Valley. Texas feels more like the Californians have escaped to Texas. I think that there's some demographics to bear that out. But what is happening in this inland Northwest region? Like, who are the people interested in coming there? Like, what's the inside scoop on that region?
Yeah. So I would say, where do we start? So yeah, so Moscow, Idaho, something we can get into later is actually the church and denomination I'm part of actually had a lot of its origins in Moscow, which is where that topic comes up, which is actually very separate from, largely, despite some very similar roots to the readout movement itself.
Okay.
So looking at the readout and then just looking at demographics of people I know just around me, we live in one of the, you know, metro areas of the I say metro areas, but this is, again, metro areas of the inland Northwest, which is
right.
under a million people total, yeah, in a multi-state area. Mm-hmm. So you've got a pretty broad selection. People that came from the Midwest, largely when property prices were still relatively affordable in the inland Northwest. So that's you're talking 2000s and earlier. At this point, the prices have climbed so far here that's not a very realistic option for someone that's relocating, unless largely they're coming from California, Washington, Oregon. The vast majority of relocatees that are coming here are coming from those states. So largely the folks I know or work with through Survival Realty are either often extended families. So you'll have grandparents, and kids and their grandkids, all moving up, largely within a year or two of each other, that will just basically form the wagon train, and say we're getting out of California or wherever it is because we see what's going on, with just kind of culture becoming unfriendly, either to them because of their personal beliefs or just the increasing feel of just utter chaos and uncertainty as far as living in some of those major metro areas.
Yeah.
So they'll uproot and come up here and be largely just looking for jobs, trying to, a lot of them end up in the suburbs, really. They're not necessarily in a position to buy, you know, the 40-acre, extremely remote retreat bunker. But a lot of them are just looking to, and very happy, really, to live in a red state suburb, where, you know, you go down the street and it's a bunch of American flags and the occasional Trump flag, which is pretty typical around here. So it's just a friendly environment for people largely of conservative mindsets. Obviously, a lot of the resort towns still have a larger share of progressive liberal outlook. So there's, of course, some of the usual small town challenges there.
Yeah.
And then you also get, I would say, a decent number of early retirees, successful people have either been successful in business or finance, or also a lot of people that are taking pensions from, for example, Southern California police and fire departments are a significant portion of people that relocate up to North Idaho.
Oh, wow, interesting.
Because they're coming up, they've taken their retirement, they've taken their home equity, and they move up here. That's actually a, you know, pretty well considered fairly well known trend, both here and there, that the inland Northwest is the place to go when you retire.
Interesting. Okay, so I have one follow up question, Roland. I'm sorry that I'm hogging the mic, but I've been thinking lately about the ways in which our different Doomer Optimism guests are part of some sort of like historical lineage. And so I heard you say, like, you know, the wagon trail. And to what extent do you see this as this kind of movement to a place, throwing off the shackles of some other place, as in alignment with this like American frontier mentality? Or not? Do you see that?
Oh yeah, Roland, did you want to jump in on that?
Oh, was that for me or for?
No, that was for Jonathan.
Oh, okay. yeah, no. So for me, yeah. I mean, it is literally my lineage. My third great grandfather literally loaded up the family in the wagons from Missouri right before the Civil War broke out, and took them all out to California. We have a lot of the oral history from that family. I don't know exactly what his reasoning was. I don't know that he was, you know, intentionally trying to get out of Dodge before the war. I like to think that. but they came out. They settled in Mendocino County of California. And my family was there for quite a while, again, until my parents uprooted and moved to the inland Northwest. So yeah, I would say there has definitely been that, let's say, very definite strain in my own family. I think that is something that is a really broader cultural tendency, largely in the Western U.S., where we're not that far removed from those origins. If you, even in the inland Northwest, I mean, really, there's very few, you know, towns or buildings that are, you know, they're all less than 200 years old. They're was not a whole lot of civilization per se out here until quite recently. So that heritage feels quite close. There's, you know, places where, you know, people's grandparents still remember when, you know, there was no road through the valley. It was just a dirt track.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. All right, sorry, Roland, you go. I'm asking too many in a row.
Oh, no. Jonathan, so we're talking about different groups that have showed up in that inland Northwest, interior Northwest region. A while back, there was an article, you may have read it, entitled "There's Going to Be a War in Montana." obviously that's a bit hyperbolic.
Yeah, no, I'd go ahead.
Do you see those conflicts? I mean, do you think there is a brewing conflict in that region between different political groups, or?
Yeah, that was a very interesting article. And man, that one definitely made me think for a while. I don't think I have a fully developed picture of that. So what they're contrasting, I can't remember their author now, is you've got a very high level of wealth that's coming up to certain areas of the Inland Northwest. I think they focused on the Bozeman, Big Sky area of Montana, Jackson, Wyoming is very similar. And there's similar little pockets of the same tendency kind of across the Inland Northwest, and a broad picture of land prices and home prices rising very dramatically. And that is creating a real challenge for, I can think of, you know, my own in-laws who are, you know, young couples with a couple kids. They're renting and, you know, would love to buy a house, but the way the real estate market is right now, it really feels out of reach. And I think that does create a significant level of resentment at not so much oriented towards the people that have moved here, but kind of towards the financial system that has made it so unattainable. A lot of the, when you talk about the multi-billionaires and their, you know, 1,000-acre ranches or whatever it is, by and large, they're kind of not super visible in the sense of that was described in that article, where it's necessarily going to attract a lot of overt ire or conflict. It's not like they're sitting right there for you to walk down the street and go burn down, right? Like you would see in a wealthy subdivision, perhaps, you know, in a major city. So it's less of an overt thing and more of a frustration, I think, with the system as a whole. So I have a hard time picturing direct conflict simply because I have a hard time picturing who the combatants would be in that sense. But there is largely a major level of resentment towards the, I'd say towards the federal government, towards the broad financial system that a lot of people, you know, feel is trying to push them down. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I have to caveat that by saying that 20 to 30 years ago, North Idaho, as one particular example, the town of Coeur d'Alene, which is now a large resort town, was, you know, fairly small, fairly depressed before, you know, the resort came in and a lot of businesses started up. And now you can drive through that town and, you know, it's suburbs for miles upon miles. Huge population increase. Really significant increase in prosperity and wealth and opportunity for a lot of people as well. So you can look at that town and say, it comes to mind because it's become so expensive there. I was doing some research recently, and you know, properties, if you're looking for a 5-acre property with a large house anywhere near that area, you're talking $1 million plus. It's not an easy market to find property in. So that can make it, and suburban houses are starting at $400,000 for anything that is still in good condition. So it's a tough market. It's a tough market to find property for people in. But it's also a market that actually now has a substantial economic base, which really wasn't the case 30 years ago. So there's pros and cons there.
Interesting.
Off the cuff, I'm just curious. We've had Keturah Lamb on the show before. Do the Rawls family have any connection with the Lamb family? And her dad's a famous politician, kind of famous politician in Montana, a libertarian politician, John Lamb.
I can't say that we've the name is familiar, but I can't say we've had any direct interaction with them.
Okay, I'm just thinking. I'm trying to wrap my head around this, like,
yeah, absolutely,
inner Mountain West.
Like, I would say one thing, particularly talking the American Readout movement. You know, it's easy to talk about it as a movement, but it really is a truly leaderless idea more than anything else. There is no, you know, despite what the news would like to tell you, there are no secret meetings.
Okay. Well, okay. So let's shift over to something that is slightly more organized. This church, group, organization, that movement, I'm not sure exactly what word you would use, but that's based in Moscow, Idaho.
Yeah,
talk
so.
a little bit about that. And I know it's kind of the source of your optimism. You've posted a few times about, you know, these really positive scenes happening in these this church community. So I'd be curious to hear, like, yeah, what is it? What's the history of it? And yeah, what's your role in it? And then what good things do you see going on?
Yeah, so my own family background is non-denominational Reformed Baptist. In more recent years, I've moved into a more Presbyterian line, which brought me where I am right now in part of the denomination, the Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches, which is not necessarily headquartered, but kind of grew up around some churches, largely in Moscow, but is now nationwide, international. It's a very small conservative Presbyterian denomination. I think the distinctive thing is a unofficial motto they have of all of Christ for all of life, which is to largely say that there's application of God's law, of God's word for every aspect of life, not in an oppressive way, but in the sense that it's ordered in a way that actually works and reality works when you're in line with the way it's created, which really is ultimately a positive, joyful thing that leads to flourishing rather than to chaos. So we're members of a congregation here of about 400 people. About half of those are under the age of 18. So we're very child friendly. We've got a, you know, we don't do children's church or separate nursery. So it's a big crowd of adults and children and babies, and it's a fun time on Sunday mornings. And yeah, I'm very optimistic in seeing, I've got fairly young children myself, but in seeing the young people that are growing up in this community, and knowing that there's, you know, many communities like this nationwide, just in our own little tiny sliver of Christendom, as it were, where I see a lot of optimism. There's a big support for homeschooling, for Christian education, that really goes back to, try and get back to the roots of our cultural heritage, you know, starting from the Middle East, coming through Greece and Rome, through the Germanic cultures, through the English cultures, and then, of course, then to the Americas. You've just got a huge, huge legacy culturally that's feels like it's largely underappreciated by our educational system at large. And I really enjoy being able to be part of that, seeing that, and raising our own children in that. And yeah, ultimately, it's a optimistic eschatology of saying that slowly but surely, like a mustard seed growing into a, you know, great tree, as the Bible puts it, that there is a future for the world, for the church. And so in that sense, even though there are doubtless hard times to come, we are very optimistic.
Roland, do you have something you want to add there?
Yeah. it's interesting because you get, obviously, I think the Rawls clan could be pretty pretty squarely described as on the right. Some would say even far right, but one of the things that your father was known for, if I'm not mistaken, was actually not, I wouldn't describe it as like a race blind position, but he firmly not in the racialist camp as far
yes.
as right wing prepper movements. And that's always sort of an element of the fringe survivalist right. So, Jonathan, can you elaborate on that, on why
yeah,
your dad?
Absolutely. Yeah, so I can say, so he's been, I would say actually race blind is probably the best descriptor of what his outlook is. He comes from largely that, I'd say, broadly evangelical heritage of looking at every human being of one blood from Adam. We are all created in God's image. We are all equal before God in Christ. And so that leads him to a largely libertarian, as much. So I'd say his thinking is largely libertarian influenced in many ways. Based on that fundamental equality that we all have as created beings, that we are all one in that respect, and can all be treated on an even playing field. So he would say, yeah, race has nothing to do with it. When you talk about the American readout, people want to associate that back with things like the Aryan Brotherhood, the Northwest Imperative, and things like that. In the 40-ish years ago, that were these racialist movements that had a similar pattern of, you know, trying to identify a part of the United States that could be an ethnic homeland. And there's, you know, obviously there's a similarity there, right? They're looking at the same area. The racialists are looking at this as a racial homeland. The survivalists are looking at this just as a place to live, to where American culture at large is still quite sound, completely apart from any racial aspect. Yeah, obviously because there's overlap there, again, around the margins, you're going to have that. And that's something that obviously gets very frequently brought up when we're talking mainstream media, things like that. Yeah. So it's something that we kind of just, at this point, I've grown up with this and heard it so many times, I just kind of laugh at it at this point. And I think that's largely the attitude of the, you know, people I know as well. You know, we don't deny that there are some people, you know, in or on the margins of our circles that might hold those objectionable views. I'm not going to go out and, you know, witch hunt people for it. But I'm not going to embrace and promote it either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ashley, you got anything?
When I'm listening to you talk, Jonathan, I'm thinking about, in some ways, like I'm going to go into murky territory that I don't usually like to talk about, but in some ways, this like ethnic, this return to like ethnic clan politics is just, it's just kind of impossible in the American experiment. Mm-hmm. And I think like, if we're trying to bring forth an American heritage, it makes much more sense to just kind of, like, we can't unmix, really. you know, we came from all sorts of, like, lineages. I mean, even when you're saying, like, you know, like, Greek and Roman and Germanic and, you know, it's really impossible to unmix at this point. And so I think just thinking about clans as, like, geographic or local or political or church-based just makes so much more sense than, like, the racial and ethnic stuff, which is just... It seems like such a dead end in the world that we're in now.
Yeah, I would say, I'm curious, Roland, hear your thoughts on that too. But I find it largely to be a ineffective shorthand for trying to address the deeper issues. Right. I mean, I try to stay away from these topics, but again, thinking even just, I'm not an expert in these areas, but looking at, you know, Black America, the marriage rates out of wedlock, birth rates were not always bad. Right. And there were reasons for that. It's not there's not a genetic thing. It's not a ethnic thing. It's a societal thing. I don't think the solution is reparations and affirmative action and, you know, all these, this agenda that gets promoted. But I think we're right in seeing that there was, I would say, an intentional effort, to ultimately destroy that culture. And I mean, I would say there's the same, that was just the trial run for what's being applied to everyone now.
Yeah, well, and I want to toss it to Roland too and get his thoughts, but like, my initial thought on that is just, I don't know, I can understand the impulse to want to have a shorthand to know who's in and who's out. So like, who's trustworthy and who's not, who's somebody who's like, of a like mind enough that I'm not going to be so apart in morality that we're going to have such different understandings of right and wrong that we're going to have constant strife. But on the other hand, like there's a whole history of just like sort of, it's like a Wendell Berry kind of esque being a good neighbor, you know, despite differences, finding ways to be a good neighbor, and finding those points of commonality for whatever shared, you know, project or activity you're involved in, whether it's, you know, just your community or your church or whatever else. But I understand the impulse of wanting to know like who's in and who's out. But then the dark side of that impulse is like purity policing and witch hunts. So, I mean, there's no silver bullet in that direction either. But Roland, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very difficult subject, obviously.
Yeah.
But it is one that comes up time and time again in these sorts of discussions. And I think I would actually caution against ascribing this sort of thing to the term clan, because I think that the clan-based nation model in some ways presents an alternative to more racialist or more like ethnographically denoted forms of alliance and division. A clan traditionally, you know, is built around a central family and a group of closely related and closely aligned families, but it also presents the opportunity to bring in people into that clan structure and to bring in other families and other units into a broader nation as their own clan structure. So I'm getting really like, you know, like galaxy brain right here. There is a way to create a system of identity around networks of families and local groupings, I think, which creates a system where you have a belonging and support networks, which is really what people are looking for.
Yeah.
Without having to go to this like you know, racial level, because when we're talking about like white race, that's like a, I don't know, maybe like 800 million people or something. Like, this is a very,
that's an even harder concept than loyalty to the United States, let alone your own community.
Yeah, and even in the United States, you're still talking about like 150 million people maybe that are white American. I'm not sure. It's a lot. So I think it is best to ground oneself in maybe not Dunbar's number level stuff, but I think Dunbar's number is a good basis. And then you kind of bridge out from there on a more local, regional level in terms of your networks of accountability, your networks of, like Jonathan was talking about Presbyterianism, the covenant is a big thing in Presbyterianism. And I think you can apply covenantalism on a broader scale than even like church polity. You can think about a community of people on a local level that sort of covenants together, makes a common bond, so to speak, to behave in certain ways, to look after the community, to defend the community, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Just starting to look into these sort of alternative ways of, God, Neil's going to get on to me for sound like a hippie here. but a little hippie-ish, but it's also very like trad if you want to look at it from that perspective too. So
yeah, well, I think.
You go ahead, Jonathan.
All right, I was going to say, as you were saying, with the, you know, sense that the United States is a nation drawn a huge number of different, you know, even if you look at the, you know, Scots, Irish, and English, or, you know, and even different, you know, subsets of those are not all the same, not all alike, ethnically or culturally, and then take that across, you know, 300 years of American history. Yeah, there's not a single uniform, you know, culture that you can necessarily easily build a fence around, because that necessarily entails homogenizing everything inside the fence, and then you don't know where to build, and you don't know where to build the fence to start with. Neither of which is something we, you know, really want to have here. Yeah. So I think a approach that that kind of accepts the subsidiarity, the fractal nature, like you say in Maryland, of clans and networks, is really what we need to incorporate into our thinking. I can think of my local community, right? We've got a bunch of Presbyterians here, but we're a tiny fraction of the population of our town or our county. So it's not like we can say, well, this is going to be a Presbyterian county. But on the other hand, there are a very significant number of Christians, by and large, of Catholic, Orthodox even, and of course, mainstream evangelical Christians, all of whom share some very important foundations and outlooks. And even if we're not going to worship together on Sundays, we share a lot of the same concerns and the same principles as far as what we want to have taught in the schools, what we want our culture to look like, what we think our, you know, expectations of public behavior should be, things like that.
Yeah.
And we kind of need to be able to incorporate that.
Yeah. So nobody asked me, but I'm going to just tell you guys that one thing I'm realizing, so I'm probably will announce it by the time this podcast gets released, that I'm moving back to Chicago from Uruguay. And part of the motivation is basically like, I'm realizing that this thing that I like had to do all this sociology to figure out was good, which is free association networks of people who are interdependent and who share similar values and want to help one another, like already exists in my neighborhood that I'm from in Chicago. And it's not really hippie at all. Am I there?
Yeah.
Okay. And it's not hippie at all. It's actually like a working class way to get by. And basically, like, one example is Patrick's dad. His best friend growing up is the Daly family, and he's the Fitzgerald family. And these two families together have formed a kind of clan. And the Dalys have four kids, you know, that are now adults and are all married. And the Fitzgeralds have four kids. And now, even though the Daly parents have passed along, these eight now families are like a superstructure, like a super family, where you know you can rely on each other. There's constant, like, you know, sharing of resources, babysitting each other's kids, like showing up to each other's events. But then all of like the Fitzgerald cousins know all the Daly cousins, and it kind of networks out from there. And there's a similar thing going on with my dad. He's a Chicago Fire Department retiree. And there's like a fireman clan of people who like know each other through the fire department, have like had relationships over the years. And so, and the trade is kind of by reputation. It's like, are you somebody who's reliable? Are you somebody who's shown up over the years? Are you somebody who knows what they're talking about, you know? And like, it's pretty obvious to me that this is like a very Dunbar number phenomenon. Like, you know these people, you've grown up with them, you know through time that they're trustworthy. It's not like a checklist of ideology. It's like a longitudinal experience of trust that like really makes it work. And so I was going to ask you about like the secret sauce of your church community, but I'm just like answering my own questions that nobody asked. But anyways, yeah, I just would love to hear more, like, yeah, some detail about, you know, your church community and these kinds of networks that you're building out.
Yeah, that's a really cool and exciting prospect for you and your family. I really hope that's a really fantastic, positive move for you. And it's something I've spoken to, too. It's like, you know, yeah, I end up working with people that are, you know, kind of looking for the perfect place. But, you know, the fact is, there isn't a perfect place for everybody that's, you know, optimal for the end of the world or optimal for you. It really is one that, you know, maybe just the question of where you belong yourself.
Right.
And that's a pretty important factor. So, yeah, I think our community is largely, it feels like we're very much starting that. the population of our area has, you know, doubled, tripled over the decades, and there isn't a lot of history there really. So we're really feels like we're kind of starting from the bottom and building that up. We've got about, you know, 20 years at our church of, you know, history of the families that came in and founded it, and that, you know, their kids grew up in the church, and now most of them are, you know, my friends in the church. We're fairly new to it, about 7 years now. But even then, we're now one of the established families because of the level of growth we've been having over the past years.
Right.
So that's something that we are still very much learning how to do, because this is not a, you know, small town in the backwoods where no one ever leaves and no one ever comes. This is
right.
This is a collection of people brought together by an ideology, to be honest. I don't deny.
Yeah.
I think ideology is largely fairly important in a mass culture. Because you have to have some way to identify people that are like-minded, that share values, really who just, you know, are friends on the level of being able to look at life and find commonality with. I think there's, you know, friendships that are across ideologies and across cultures. And then there's the friendships of the people that, you know, I can look at them and say, I mean, for me, it's as a parent, it's like, I want my kids to grow up to be the same kind of kids that they're raising their kids to be. And as much as I can be friends with a lot of people from very different outlooks, I also have to think about the kind of people I'm providing for my own children to be modeled after.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's where ideology kind of provides that filtering mechanism to kind of help us find a core community closer to Dunbar's number within, you know, a community of 20 or 100 or a million people, because that's ultimately what people are drawn to. So we don't just have a, you know, village church now, because the village has grown so far that there's a huge variety of viewpoints. It's not homogeneous. You can't just pick the people next door and expect them to have all those same values and everything else. You can be a good neighbor, but you can't necessarily feel that you can't necessarily say, oh, you're going to be a positive influence in my child's life in the direction that I think is important. And those people you kind of have to pick out a little more carefully.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think churches definitely provide an excellent outlet for this sort of thing. Or any religious organization for that matter, it adds that additional grounding in a shared worldview and shared morality that I think secular groups always sort of lack.
Yeah, and it's something that I'd say family is the other very important complement to that, because when you start talking about cousins and extended family, depending on the family, but in our family, that's going to come with a wide variety of largely Christian, but, you know, even fairly distinct, you know, traditions within that even. And family connections and neighbor connections as well are kind of the flip side of that, where you don't pick those people. Those are the people you learn to live with and live with the differences. So I think you need both. You can't have, you know, all one or all the other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead. Do you have something rolling? Because I do.
Oh, you don't?
No, I do. I do.
Good.
So this is something that we mentioned in the right before we started recording this, the overlap between your religion and the prepping. Where's like the intersection there? Do a lot of the people in the church have this prepper mentality? Is this like, you know, are people who are in the church drawn to that area as like a rebellion to the world order, as you put it? Like, what's the overlap between these two worlds?
I'd say the overlap is it's there, but it's not a major overlap. I think it's more of a factor of Again, it's kind of some shared values, some similarities in thought in along certain lines. I would say there's very few, I have very few, you know, church friends who would necessarily identify themselves as preppers per se. But then they'll, you know, ask me a question like, hey, I feel like I need to get some storage food put away. What should I do? So it's, you know, so there's a lot of overlap. And again, that's, I think, because prepping does just kind of underlie a lot of traditional American culture as well. So in some sense, I don't think you're ever too far removed from it unless you're living in the big city and getting everything on Uber Eats and you don't have a pantry at all. So, yeah, I'd say, and I mean, I think there's, the COVID situation definitely brought that out, as far as a very strong, desire to see, local independence, self-government, and concern about largely federal and state overreach and tyranny, and obviously that motivates people too.
Okay, mm-hmm. So wait, this is actually important for the prepper book. Is in your okay? So there's like the prepping community that's mm-hmm. you know Redoubt, and then there's your church community. In Chris Ellis's heuristic, there are those who are driven by a kind of millenarian apocalyptic mm-hmm. religious sensibility of the end of the world, and then there are those who are driven by government overreach. It seems like you kind of have a foot in both worlds.
Yeah, I would say I obviously know and work with a lot of people that are in the millenarian camp. I'm not so much. But I would say, again, in the Northwest, disdain, at the least, for government is pretty widespread. There's a lot of people, like I said, a lot of people that still have their Trump flags up. And, you know, I've got sympathy with them. So I would think, I'd honestly say, when you're talking conservative culture, at least in this region, that almost feels like a given. The government, especially the federal government, is heavily distrusted. And, you know, we have a very strong appreciation for the founding principles, America's founding principles, you know, going back to the Declaration of Independence and before. It's just kind of the background.
And gun ownership, Second Amendment rights.
Again, culturally, that, I mean, you don't even have to be particularly conservative in this region to, you know, largely be pro-gun. So yeah. It's very cultural even.
Okay.
Yeah, Jonathan, so your business, you're helping people find bug out locations, is that mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, so yeah, Survival Realty. Yeah, so we've got an online marketplace that's been running for 10 plus years, and we do a little bit of direct real estate, but it's mostly on the helping people connect, both here and then in the Northwest and nationwide. Yeah, so we work with people. I'd say it's a pretty good mix. As far as the buyers, you've got the people that are looking for that, you know, $1 million out in the woods cabin, as their, you know, second or third home, and they've got the money to burn on setting it up as their, you know, go-to bunker in the end of the world situation. And then you've got the people that are really just wanting to get out of the big city, really looking for more of the homesteading type lifestyle, and looking for a affordable piece of rural land, which obviously trying to work with both those people is provides quite a contrast. And then the other people we end up working with are really the folks that are a lot of them relocated to or even live in a very rural or remote area, and now that they're a stage in life where that's no longer what they need. And so they're, you know, downsizing, moving to be closer to family, closer to services or anything else. And so we end up working with them to help find buyers for those properties. And, you know, that perspective, you know, again, kind of gives me a consideration, you know, just to think about the long term of what that's going to look like for you, not just, you know, when you're 40, but, you know, when you're 70. And that's something that, you know, needs to play into our considerations.
Yeah. Mm. I'm wondering how common the phenomena of rich-ish you know, people like in their not retirees, but people still in working age, moving out to start homesteads and having no skills at all is.
Yeah. So it's, some of them are just that kind of where they're setting up a, you know, very remote vacation cabin, essentially. And they might be, you know, putting it, laying in the supplies to do the homesteading stuff. But they're probably relying on a local caretaker or something like that. So they're not really homesteading in that respect. But then, yeah, you've got the people that are coming out to really make it go of it. I frequently caution people against, you know, trying to self-sufficiency is a that's a very high goal. Self-reliance, you know, just some level of production on your land even is a that's a major goal and a huge learning curve there. So I'm definitely cautioning people, you know, don't overestimate what you can do and how hard it's going to be. But I think, yeah, there's a lot of people that are looking to, looking to make that change. But it depends on your area. The folks I think are doing that most successfully are largely the ones going to low cost of living areas, such as Appalachia and Arizona, places like that, where you can still get land and a house and not be saddled with a huge mortgage payment.
I'm just thinking about a family who I met, an American, very successful business guy who's like maybe mid 40s, who moved here to Uruguay. And, I was talking to him too, and we became friends. He's an American guy, he's from Illinois. But he's like starting a regenerative ranch, and it was like, oh my gosh, he's never done anything like this before, and he's doing it. But he also took like a kind of business mindset to it, where he hired local experts to, like, experts as in like people who are actually on the land, like actual ranchers and this kind of thing, not like consultants, to come in and like tell him how to do regenerative ranching on his land. He had a caretaker. And, you know, I'm just wondering about this whole world. Like, are we gonna, Chris Mage has been on the podcast a few times, and he's got this theory of this ecologically balanced future is the small farm future. And it's like, are these the, is this the frontier of that? Is that the leading edge? These people moving, neo homesteaders, like, is it a real thing? I have no idea. Neil Clark always makes fun of me and says like, homesteaders are as common as furries. They might as well not exist. Which I think is very funny, but I'm just very curious if it's like a real phenomenon or if it's kind of just the people who I've, who've been drawn to us in the podcast.
Yeah, Roland, I'm curious your perspective on that. I've got one in the Northwest, but what about your area?
I mean, I think it's a real movement. The question is, you know, what percentage of the population are we really talking about? Mm-hmm. It can be in terms like... like 100,000 people even, but as a percentage of the US population, that would still be like 0.03% or less. So,
yeah, exactly. And I think that is something you kind of see if you go to, you know, the farmer's market or something like that, you know. Yeah, there's a lot of food there, but you have to compare that to the volume that's going through every single grocery store every single day. We don't have the infrastructure, I think, to, you know, right now, to be able to, you know, do something like that. And honestly, but one thing I do think is that every local producer that you're supporting right now is helping to build that infrastructure. So you can say, it's unrealistic to go, you know, buy your beef and your milk from a local producer. But at the same time, every single person, even if it's only a few of them that are spending their money there, are adding one more local producer and increasing that capacity. So right. Yeah, maybe it's still half of 1%, but it's a little bit more.
Yeah, well, I mean, I also just think like it doesn't have to be everybody to be a thing mm-hmm. that exists. Like, I mean, this group of people could just be like the more resilient group. And if there's like shocks where supply, you know, where there's no groceries on the shelves, these people will all survive, and then the other ones won't be able to find any food. So, you know,
yeah, absolutely. And
there's just like no downside to building out those like local connections and points of resilience, really, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I do see a lot more, particularly in the as far as people going, but say buying beef straight from the producer, just seeing how much costs have gone up for grocery store beef. If you want anything besides USDA choice, if you actually want something that you know you can have some level of confidence in the quality, you're spending exorbitant amounts of money,
right?
Which is driving a lot of people that are, you know, very not very conscious of either preparedness or of the homesteading side of things to go and seek out how to, you know, buy direct from the farmer, just because the system we have is not really doing a good job.
Right.
Jonathan, so in terms of, you were talking about the affordability, and we've seen your area become much less affordable. So I'm wondering, what parts of the United States do you think are good bang for your buck for people that are looking to do this sort of homesteading or bug out location, any of that?
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing that comes in there is, again, because very few people are going to be doing any sort of total self-sufficiency in any respect. It's really a question of, I think, you know, I would say personal connections first, where your family is, cultural connections, having a community that you can align with and feel comfortable in. And again, that you want your children to grow up in and find connections in. But then also there's just the reality, the economic realities of figuring out where you can make a living, somewhere that there's, unless you're truly a remote worker, which obviously a fair number of homesteaders are, you're looking at, you know, trying to find a region that has, you know, some potential for you to actually make a living in that area. So I commute into one of the larger cities in our area to work in a manufacturing engineering job. And picking that area, you know, really should, if you're uprooting, going somewhere else, you kind of need to have some picture of how you're going to make it, unless you really are moving to an extremely low cost of living area and you're comfortable with just finding a way to get by. It's the economic challenges are very real. So,
all right. Yeah. Anything else that we haven't yet covered that you feel like is important to for us to understand on, like, the prepping question on, you know, the inland Northwest? Are you guys planning to secede?
That's always the real question. I think it should not be a forbidden topic by any means. I also don't think it's necessarily the best solution. I'd say I'm a pro 10th Amendment, pro states' rights, is what I would ultimately say my viewpoint is on, in terms of the national questions. So I hope ultimately that we can move in a direction of greater independence, politically, economically, culturally, for the individual states that avoids the need for anything dramatic.
Yeah, as if I don't have enough, like, questionable guests or associations.
Yes.
I have to go and ask that question. Anything else, Roland or Jonathan, as we wrap up?
No, I'm good. I just thank Jonathan for coming on with us.
It's been fun.
Yeah, this is super fun. Thank you so much for being our guinea pig on the prepping episode.
Yeah, it's great.
Where can people find you, follow you? What's your website for your real estate business?
Yeah, so my main web home is survivalrealty.com. I've got a newsletter there, which is mostly property, of course, but occasional newsletter articles on preparedness in general. And then you can, of course, find us on Twitter and Facebook and all that. I tweet at Jonathan Rawls.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
that's where you get the Tolkien references.
Great. Thank you so much. This was so fun.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a good time. Appreciate the discussion.